You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Behind the scenes, Joe's candid, honest counsel has made me a better president and a better commander-in-chief. And all of this makes him, I believe, the finest vice president we have ever seen. And I also think he has been a lion of American history.
Barack Obama has given his vice president the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. But how does Joe Biden rank amongst his predecessors? I'll discuss that with my guests here in the studio. Plus, as the US prepares to send the largest contingent of American soldiers to Europe in a generation, we'll ask how Vladimir Putin might respond. We'll also propose an itinerary for China's President Xi Jinping as he tours Switzerland ahead of the World Economic Forum in Davos. And as a Bruce Springsteen cover band accepts an invitation to play during Donald Trump's inauguration events, I'll ask my Monocle colleagues what band they would invite if they were becoming president. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. And as ever on a Friday, it's an in-house affair. I'm joined by three of the finest voices we could find in the building. You'll recognise them all. Marcus Hippie, hello.
Hello, Steve.
Thomas Lewis from Toronto and Wales, hello.
Good evening, Steve.
And Henry Rhys Sheridan from upstairs and from Wales, hello.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
There we are. So, Thomas, Henry, Marcus, welcome to you all. Very good to have you here. Thomas, you've had a nice week here in London. You've been, you know, here for a little bit now, haven't you?
I've been here for a week. It's been a lovely way to kick off 2017, darkening the doorways of Midori House, as I like to on occasion,
but it's been, and we've been planning, haven't we?
We
things
have been.
For you to do when you get, when you hot foot it back to Toronto.
Absolutely, I'm quite hopefully to some sunnier climes, Steve, because it's very cold in Toronto.
You're worried about the snow?
I'm a bit worried about the snow.
It did snow today briefly, and everyone got very, very excited.
I mean, it was very picturesque.
It was lovely. It didn't last very long.
No.
Marcus Hippie, have you had a good start to 2017 so far?
It's been a very good start. I was quite excited about the snow today as well. I don't know if you saw me taking photos. I was going to send them ironically to my friends in Finland to see what's happening in London. It's been a good week. Many, many new beginnings and new projects. One of them obviously being the Menu Live. That's been taking a bit of my time.
Exactly. Tell us briefly about the Menu Live.
Just briefly, February 24th, Friday evening, the Menu is going to be broadcast live from Midori House and we'll have an audience there. We're going to be asking if London's dining scene is broken. Is London too expensive? Have we lost the feeling of excitement? Should we have more spontaneous ideas? And so forth. I'll be there. Josh Fennett will be on stage and great panelists as well. And more info on Monocle's website.
Monocle.com. You'll find it there. Click on it. I'm sure it'll be good. And there'll be food and drink, won't there, as well, since
plenty.
It's the Menu. And it's a Friday night. It can't not be. Henry, I'm afraid we've run out of time for introductory chats.
Well, I haven't done anything this week anyway.
Okay,
so.
Fine. Okay. So look, we've got a lot to pack into the next 26, 27 minutes, including some fluff and nonsense about songs, which I want to leave at least 10 minutes for. But we're going to begin with some other fluff and nonsense. Donald Trump and the week that he's had. It seems like... Well, Thomas, you were covering the US election for us alongside our colleague in New York, Ed Stocker. And it was interesting watching the press conference the other day in that for a moment, I think I'd forgotten just what had happened in America. But that press conference really sort of brought it back to everyone, didn't it?
I think that's an absolutely perfect way of putting it, because I think I'd sort of forgotten too, you know, the drama and the sort of incredulity of the election result and the sort of the shock, I suppose, for everyone involved, really, of the sort of weeks that followed immediately afterwards. But the press conference on Wednesday was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I just couldn't quite believe. I mean, we've heard so many times throughout the campaign that, oh, well, Donald Trump will become more presidential now. He will, you know, become more serious. I mean, he hasn't and won't probably. And I just think the whole setup, this table full of his papers that were apparently proved that he was going to be, you know, legit in his business.
Those files, which were clearly filled with blank pages.
I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, a question I have is, whose idea is all of this? Is this Donald Trump being like, right, I know what'll get everyone on board. Let's have a massive show and tell, basically, of my papers, of these, blank sheets of paper. Let's get my tax attorney out. People will believe her if they don't believe me. I mean, it's so balmy. And I just wonder, you know, a lot of these things, I think, you know, it's obvious that these aren't Trump's, you know, this isn't Trump's idea. You know, someone has told him, right, let's do this. This is how you should handle this. But then something as crazy as that. I mean, you know, who is advising him, and you know, or was he just sort of so bullish and thought, I know this is going to be an absolute winner for me, and it, well, absolutely wasn't.
And Marcus, you know, when you look at his, you know, streams of invective on Twitter, you know, often at 6 a.m, it's quite clear that no one's advising him, or if they are, he's not listening.
He is not listening at all. I think that's become very clear as well. My feelings when I was following that press conference was that it was something Thomas experienced as well. For a while, I had thought that maybe it's not going to be as bad as we feared some months ago. And actually hearing from Donald Trump himself kind of reminded me of the worst ideas we thought what the future may hold. I think what this means is that we are going to have some kind of a learning curve. I think journalists is dealing with Trump. They need to think of new approaches, how to deal with him. I think world leaders may need to think about as well how to lead with Donald Trump. I think it's going to be a very different world when it comes to international diplomacy and when it comes to journalism.
But I think it's so difficult to gauge. And I think what you said at the beginning of the conversation about, you know, you'd kind of forgotten about it and then the press conference really brought it back. The optics of the American political scene at the moment, so interesting, because it does seem to oscillate between the virtual and the actual in the minds of everyone watching. And it's also very difficult to tell how much of it is orchestrated, and then how much of the orchestrated actions are actually having the intended effects. It's just so difficult to get your head round. And if it's difficult for me, then God knows what it's like for a world leader.
Thomas, we should also remember that those, and I think it's, you know, no one's hiding the fact that Donald Trump wasn't the preferred candidate of Monocle and Monocle 24. Those of us who are a little worried, to say the least, we're not alone. He has an approval rating right now of 37%, which is the lowest approval rating ever for a president-elect. It's also less than the number of people who voted for him. Now, normally you'll find that, you know, a president-elect has more support than those who voted for him, because there'll be people who are like, well, I want to back the winner, and there'll also be people like, well, look, let's give the new guy a chance. But Thomas, we're in quite uncharted waters here, where you can have a deeply unpopular president taking the oath next week.
And I think, you know, I wonder whether it's too soon, or maybe it's not soon enough, really, to start thinking about actually, you know, how does this actually play out? Are we actually going to have 4 years of a Donald Trump presidency? Because I just think, you know, going back to the press conference, you look how furious he got at the mere fact that journalists were asking him questions. And these were questions he'd been asked, you know, many times before, but he was shouting and screaming from the stage. And is he going to be able to sustain that, just, you know, from a physical sort of point of view, for the next 4 years? And, you know, honestly, you know, his Republican counterparts are surely sort of, you know, scheming and kind of plotting kind of what happens when, basically. And, you know, there are, of course, kind of, you know, stories going around that, you know, he really doesn't particularly want to do this job, really. And I think, you know, the fact that he is getting so wound up, and this whole firewall of Twitter, which is, again, sort of just absolutely, you know, extraordinary. I just think, you know, I just can't see that we're going to have 4 years of this.
And what I'm wondering is what it's like to work with Donald Trump, considering his temper. We've already seen this week when we've had some hearings with Trump's picks for his top team. They don't agree with Donald Trump in many things, which is interesting. NATO and Russia, for example, they have very different views on that. So I think it's going to be very interesting in the future to see what the dynamics are going to be between Trump and people he's going to be working very closely with.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Marcus, because that's what I wanted to move on to. Henry, if we look at what was happening on Capitol Hill this week, where you had Rex Tillerson, potential Secretary of State, James Mattis is his defence pick, Mike Pompeo, to a certain extent, the CIA choice, it sounded like they were going to be part of a completely different government. You had Rex Tillerson saying, Russia did invade Ukraine. They did annex Crimea. Putin is a danger. He didn't go as far as saying he's a war criminal, but certainly says a danger. James Mattis was saying it's absolutely vital that remain part of NATO. Pompeo, who's a CIA pick, saying we're not going to bring back torture in the CIA. These views are diametrically opposed to those of Donald Trump. It's as if this is a completely parallel administration.
You're completely right, and you've omitted to mention one of the most important guys, which is Paul Ryan, who has also been disagreeing with Trump in public this week in a town hall meeting. Yesterday he did so. And I think you mentioned, Thomas, a little bit earlier about, you know, it may be the case that Republicans are viewing Trump as a boon precisely because he might be someone who's more malleable to work with. I mean, we know the Republicans under Ryan have been formulating huge amounts of legislation, which they have been piling up at the door of the White House, essentially, over the 8 years of the Obama administration. And I think they're kind of hoping that Trump is going to be shambolic enough to be able to push his legislation past him, basically just use him as a puppet.
And you look at how Trump has tried to play this, you know, these kind of statements, these comments in these confirmation hearings this week, you know, again, via Twitter, not via any other sort of, you know, vehicle. He's saying, well, look, you know, that's exactly why I picked this team, because, you know, I want them to speak their minds, you know, I want them to sort of express their own sort of talents and skills. I mean, it's kind of nonsense, really, frankly. I mean, you know, look, he, you know, they know the political game, these people, largely. They know what they have to say to sort of get answers or, you know, get, you know, responses from the senators who are asking these questions. Donald Trump doesn't know any of that and, you know, probably won't know that very well, you know, even as president. So I think, you know, he's trying to spin himself as some great manager by having, you know, these people, you know, going directly against him. And maybe that is kind of the only political response he can make. But, I mean, for me, it doesn't ring true at all.
Okay, I want to move on a little. It's a story we've covered a bit since it was announced, but I want to get your takes on it. President Obama, in his last days in office, has said he wants to send thousands of American soldiers to Eastern Europe to protect against aggressive Russian military behaviour. The troops are going to be in Poland. It will be the largest such movement of US soldiers to Europe in decades. Marcus, when we look at Central and Eastern Europe, those countries which border Russia or are very close to Russia, many of them are concerned about the potential of Russia threatening to cross into their country or at least playing war games on their borders. Does the presence of US troops help, or is there also a worry that it might ratchet things up?
I think the feeling over there is that that is something quite concrete, something these countries need from the United States. I feel sorry for Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania in particular. What these countries have been hearing from the US during the election campaigning, there was someone, first of all, saying that these countries basically are just a suburb for St. Petersburg. Someone has been suggesting that maybe these countries are not worth defending. Donald Trump doesn't want to commit to NATO and so forth. These countries are very small. They're facing this superpower, Russia, that seems to be very unpredictable at the moment. So any support they feel like they can get from the United States is definitely welcome.
Yeah, I think that one of the interesting facets of this in relation to US domestic politics is that by sending these troops over there now in the closing weeks of the presidency, while Trump is preparing to come into office, you know, everyone knows he has been hostile towards NATO. I think Obama is creating, to steal a phrase which is sometimes applied to Israeli settlers in the West Bank, he's creating facts on the ground. He's putting, you know, human beings there.
Yeah, so the question isn't, will you send troops to these countries to help them? It's, will you take away those that are there already?
Precisely. And I think that is a very clever move and a very concrete move, pragmatic move by Obama.
I'd agree. I think it is very clever, actually, because, again, it sort of forces Trump to have to make an actual decision on something very real. And I think, you know, so far, you know, we talked about the advice he's taking, what he's listening to and that kind of things. You know, this is a very real world situation now. And I think, you know, and I don't think, you know, you could maybe argue that is President Obama, you know, playing very pure politics here, is this kind of maybe even a slightly frivolous kind of thing by actually making a very difficult situation potentially for his successor. But I think, you know, look, he's president of the United States, you know, and he's amassed these people around him. You know, this is, you know, this is something he will have to sort of deal with and will have to, you know, we'll have to have an answer for.
Marcus, I want to get a Finnish angle on this. So Finland, like Sweden, you know, in the European Union, but not in NATO. And that's despite the fact you've got quite a border that you personally know very, very well, since you were stationed quite near it at one stage, weren't you?
I was. And actually, my hometown is quite close to the border as well. And I know the Russian relations quite well, considering that three out of my four grandparents were actually refugees who had to leave the Finnish parts that were lost to Soviet Union in the Second World War. It's interesting about Finland and Russia, the relationship. It's almost like a mantra that in Finland, politicians are always repeating that we are in very good relations with Russia. Everything is fine in between us two. And I've been hearing that so much in the last, I don't know, 2 years that I feel like it's losing its meaning. Politicians are saying everything is all right at the same time. For example, just what, a year ago, the government decided that the military is going to send letters to people who would be, to let these people know what they would be doing if a war took place, what their positioning would be. And that was just to raise awareness of what the military does, supposedly. Then again, in other news, Finland, we see Finland collaborating with NATO forces more than ever before without joining NATO. So, for example,
do you think they will join NATO at some stage?
That is such a controversial issue, because in Finland we have, it's more of an older generation that still feels like the only way, the right way of dealing with Russia is to stay as independent and neutral as possible. And they see that joining NATO would actually weaken the relations between Russia and Finland significantly, which may well be true.
Okay, we'll move on. Let's talk about Joe Biden. Everyone's favourite vice president.
Big fan. Big fan of Joe.
At least compared to the last vice president, one imagines. He was surprised by his boss yesterday with the nation's highest civilian honour, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Not only that, but Barack Obama gave Biden a medal with an additional honour, one with distinction. It's only been handed to a handful of people in the past. Before we talk about that, let's hear a bit of the ceremony.
Behind the scenes, Joe's candid, honest counsel has made me a better president and a better commander-in-chief. From the Situation Room, to our weekly lunches, to our huddles after everybody else has cleared out of the room, he's been unafraid to give it to me straight, even if we disagree. In fact, especially when we disagree. And all of this makes him, I believe, the finest vice president we have ever seen. And I also think he has been a lion of American history. So, Joe, for your faith in your fellow Americans, for your love of country, and for your lifetime of service that will endure through the generations, I'd like to ask the military aide to join us on stage. For the final time as president, I am pleased to award our nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
You have to watch that as well. Biden's reaction is quite something. Henry Reece Sheridan, first of all, let's get this out of the way. He's not the greatest vice president ever, is he?
I don't know enough about the history of vice presidents. And
but I mean, that's partly it, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, how are we judging this? It's like, well, I mean, okay, he didn't persuade his boss to go to war, so he's not Dick Cheney. But then, you know, Al Gore wasn't a bad vice president. George H.W. Bush will argue that he wasn't a bad vice president.
Can you only be a less bad vice president? Is this the point that you're making, Steve? Is that the standard by which they are to be judged?
Part of the issue is, like, how do you judge a vice president, Thomas? You've got this problem that actually it's a bit of a non-job. Famously, it's, you know, yeah, it was, you know, people describe it as a warm bucket of piss. It's like, if you want to be forgotten, you become vice president. It's, you know, it's, there are a ream of jokes about why this isn't a job to do.
It is such a strange job. And I think, you know, for an international audience, you know, quite often, you know, you might not really know who the vice president is at all. But I think, you know, in the United States, you know, especially during the sort of administration in question, there is kind of a potency, I think, to the vice presidency. But I think, you know, I think I'd Joe Biden is the best vice president ever. I think he's great. I'm a real sort of fan, actually.
I know you have his poster.
Are you sure he's not just your favourite,
Thomas? You have his poster on the wall of your flat.
I do have a poster of Joe Biden on my wall in Toronto at the end of the big night in Philadelphia.
Genuinely?
Genuinely, I do.
I thought we were making a joke.
So he gave a big speech at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. So at the end, and everyone had these placards, big orange placards with one word on them, in bold white letters, Joe. So I was like, right, I need to get one. So I scrambled down into the hall. There was one left that I could see. Everyone else had sort of stocked them up. Got it, basically, and I could see a little old lady at the other side of the aisle trying to get it as well. And I was like, right,
elbowed her out of the way.
Back off, yeah, exactly.
Well done, Tom.
And it's hanging on my wall in Toronto.
A bit of political sort of, you know, paraphernalia. Absolutely, is always good to steal. Yeah. Henry.
Yeah, I just think if you think about the reasons that people come into the position of the office of vice president as well, it's just so interesting, right? Because like they're almost always selected because of their instrumental value as running mates way before whoever becomes president knows that they're going to become president. And so you imagine some of the combination that history could have thrown up. I mean, Sarah Palin, the idea of her being vice president and then something happening while she was in office and her becoming president, it just seemed absurd.
Well, it's about the contrast, though, isn't it? And I think from the start, when Obama chose Biden, you know, Joe Biden kind of was a lot of things that Obama wasn't. He had experience, he had knowledge of various fields Obama didn't have. But I think Joe Biden has actually got quite a long list of achievements in the vice presidency that a lot of his predecessors just don't have.
And something I think it doesn't necessarily make a great vice president, but why I've liked him and why I know that many people like him is that he didn't seem that awfully well media trained. If you go online and Google what written about Joe Biden, there are quite a lot of lists of his top 10 gaffes. And I think that is sometimes good. He actually seems like a human, not like a robot.
Okay. You feel like a human, not like a robot as well, Marcus. You and Joe, you could do a job share. Marcus, I want to get your views on this next story because we're heading to Switzerland now, where China's President Xi Jinping is soon to embark on a whirlwind tour. Can we say a whirlwind tour of a, you know, not a massive country?
I don't know.
He's going to Bern and Geneva.
A wind tour.
Ahead
at least.
Anyway, he's going to be speaking at Davos, the World Economic Forum, which is interesting in itself. We talked about that a bit. However, what I want to talk to you guys about is what he should be doing while he's there. Marcus, you've spent some time in our Zurich bureau. What would you be arranging for Xi and his President Xi? And I don't know if his wife is going with him, but, you know, she's a singer. You know, there might be certain things that she might like to do as well.
I think it's nice to walk around Zurich, but I think he definitely should go and visit Krunenhalle restaurant, a bar that is one of Monocle's favourites. You can go there for a nice drink, you can go for a nice dinner over there, you can enjoy the art that's on the wall. There's some paintings by Chagall and Picasso, and after that you can follow how a major Chinese business comes to Switzerland and buys that place.
Henry, you've also spent some time in our Zurich bureau, working hard, beavering away, occasionally going for a swim, I gather. What else would you suggest Xi Jinping and entourage get up to?
So I just think just ride around the city on the trams, because I think the punctuality combined...
Oh, you did a tall story about this, didn't you?
This is correct, yeah. I've become a borderline obsessive light railway enthusiast since my visit there and become a bit anoraky about it. So maybe eschew the limousine for that.
Okay, Tom, I'm not going to ask you because you haven't been there recently. Instead, we're going to move on. Thank you very much for that, Henry, by the way. Good advice. I don't think he will get out of the limo, but, you know, security issues, but
just
still.
Tip.
So look, let's go back to where we started and Mr. Trump. He has had a little bit of trouble in securing high-profile musicians to perform at his presidential inauguration events. You may recall that Barack Obama had Aretha Franklin at his first, and then topped that, or equaled that, depending on your view, equaled, I think we should say, with Beyonce second time around, which, you know, isn't bad. Trump has struggled. However, we can reveal that he has this artist confirmed. Yeah, it's actually not Bruce Springsteen. In fact, it's not even Bruce Springsteen's band, the E Street Band, because, of course, Bruce is not really a Trump fan. Instead, it's the B Street Band, a Springsteen cover act.
So, let's not talk about how sad that is. Instead, I thought I'd ask the three of you who you would get to perform at your inauguration, or, you know, at your prize giving when we sort of give you a promotion or something. We should have some sort of monocle inauguration like that. So, look, Thomas Lewis, if we were to make you, I don't know,
the Prince of Wales, possibly.
Fine, okay. If we were to make you the Prince of Wales,
rather modestly suggesting that.
I think that means you have to marry Prince Willie. Anyway, I don't know how that works.
That would be that would be a big moment, surely. It would. For Wales and for also Prince
William. At least get into the monocle minute.
And also he's married already. But still, let's say this was going to happen. Tell us which song you'd have and perhaps introduce it.
So, I think if I was going to be inaugurated or invested, actually, say, as the Prince of Wales, for example, I'd want something rather heroic by one of the finest artists that my dear nation has to offer. So, I'm going to introduce it now. This is by the one and only Bonnie Tyler, and this is Holding Out for a Hero. Wouldn't you be pumped up for my sort of reign as the Prince of Wales if that was playing on my phone?
Only if there were a dance routine as well that you were involved in.
That I was involved. Well, maybe why not? You know, we're all about breaking political rules and conventions at the moment, aren't we? So why not? I'd learn to dance for my big day.
I can only describe that selection as appropriate,
thanks.
I think, to the event, that hypothetical event.
Okay, we'll come back to Thomas's choice in a moment. But first of all, Henry, you tell us about your more sedate Welsh choice.
Right, so I'm also imagining being inaugurated as the Prince of Wales. I'm going to have to recruit Thomas quite heavily for explanation of my choice. It's a song called Sospan Fach. I think we better play it.
I think you just spat a bit all over the microphone.
And then that's intentional. And then Thomas can explain what's going on afterwards.
Little Marshall. I feel like Wales is about to invade.
It's quite Slavic, isn't it?
It's yeah. great. I'm yeah. feeling, I've got tingles at the back of my neck with that.
So you will offer a translation, Thomas.
So that is Sospan Fach. Now, very a rugby anthem.
Is that saucepan?
Latterly. So a small saucepan.
Mm. Small saucepan,
small,
is
small
it?
Small saucepan,
okay.
yeah.
Okay.
And it's a tale of Mary Ann, who's hurt her finger. And it's about the saucepans. The saucepan's boiling on the fire. Sospan fawr yn berwi ar y tân. So big saucepan boiling on the fire.
Can I just say, now that I know what the lyrics are, I'm less scared
boiling
of,
on
of the
floor.
Welsh army.
It's a saucepan for every room in the house, basically. But it's a real anthem for West Wales and the Scarlets rugby team.
Okay.
I hear that on every rugby day. It's great. Good choice, Henry.
Before we run out of time, let's hear, Marcus, what you would be... If you had become Finnish president, what would you be having?
Okay, first of all, sorry, guys. This song is not from Wales, but it's not from that far away either. It's actually from England or by an English artist. So Eddie Eagle Edwards, if people remember him, was a British ski jumper.
Exactly. 1988 Olympics.
1988 Calgary. I grew up watching that and he was my hero because he never gave up even though he was utter
terrible.
Crap. He was the worst. Anyway, he became so successful in Finland, we loved him so much, that he ended up releasing a single over there. This is Hyppää Eetu Hyppää. Let's have a listen. Vaikea onkin viimeisin.
Hyppää Eetu hyppää. The thing about that is you know that he is desperately looking down at a piece of paper and reading that phonetically.
and his accent is awful. But it worked really well. This song was quite a big hit in Finland and I was just checking some numbers. His biggest performance was there in the late 1980s when he performed to 70,000 people.
Oh,
how many
goodness.
Times Wembley? That's like two times
that's
Wembley
more,
or something.
No,
people
that's going
to turn up
Wembley.
To Inauguration Day in Washington next week, surely.
70,000 people came out to see Eddie the
that's
Eagle.
Extraordinary.
Singing bad. Finnish.
There's about 60% of the Finnish population as well, isn't it? Just put it into perspective. I think that's important.
During this show, we've been talking about what makes a great vice president, what makes a great person. And like, he has some of those characteristics. He never gave up. He tried again and again until someone changed the rules and he wasn't allowed to participate in his ski jumping competitions anymore.
Well, there we are. Okay, so I think we can conclude that Wales is invading with a saucepan, that Finland has some weird taste in music, and Tom thinks for some reason that he's a hero. I think on that note, we'll end it.
The rest of the room there.
Thank you very much for joining us today on Midori House. My thanks to Henry, to Thomas, to Marcus. The programme was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. Send all your complaints to him, dg@monocle.com. Researched by Jolene Goffin and Helena Girit. I finally got her name right. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next. Then Marcus is here with a menu at 1900, the Monocle Daily at 2200. We're back with Midori House, 1800 London time, 1300 New York on Monday. Have a great weekend. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.